number of people who've arrived as international students, supposedly to our world-class higher education sector, ended up working stacking shelves in supermarkets. It provided a way for more and more people to feel slightly dependent on the state. The growth of the welfare state has undermined the concept of democracy entirely, because people will just keep voting for more welfare benefits, and an ever dwindling group of people will have to pay for them, but they'll be outvoted at every turn.
Hello and welcome to the Reform Party podcast. Before I forget, let me remind you to subscribe and to like this episode. If you have watched some of our other episodes, I'm sure that you're already a follower, but you might not be subscribing, and we would love to get you on so that you get automatic updates and notifications whenever we have a new episode. So I'm delighted today to welcome Fred de Fossard to the podcast. Thank you very much for being here today, Fred.
Thank you so much for having me on, Wendy. Good afternoon.
Now, Fred, I'm sure that one of the issues that hasn't passed you by is what's going on in the wider world, not just the local British economy, but what's happening in Trump and Greenland, how that's going to affect the world economy. And I'd like to come on to that, because I think that's a really vital part of our discussion today. But I would like to start with matters closer to home. I'd like to get your opinion on where we are in terms of the British economy. And I'd like to also touch on fiscal policy as well as monetary policy, some very big topics for this afternoon. Please open and tell us what your views are and what the Prosperity Institute position is on those matters.
Certainly. Thank you so much for asking, Wendy. I oversee our sort of economic and regulatory work at the Institute. We take a huge interest in this subject matter. The picture, I mean, I think overall is bad. I'm sure your listeners will agree it's bad. But there's a lot more nuance in beneath the sort of headline picture of an economy which is flatlining right now. I think we take a huge amount of interest in at Prosperity Institute is the state of the labour market, and then particularly the state of the energy sector and the energy industry in Britain, which has huge ripple-on effects for the wider economy. If we look at the labour market, first of all, unemployment is reaching highs not seen since around the time of the financial crisis. But we have a particularly weird mixture of things going wrong in the labour market right now. Employment in the public sector has actually gone up a little bit, but employment in the private sector has gone down. Of course, you will know it's the private sector that pays for the public sector, so that can't have a good effect for our public finances overall. The working age benefits bill is going through the roof, but it seems that it's not just unemployment benefits, i.e. people looking for a job, which going up. It is also sickness benefits and disability benefits, which seem to be hitting new highs. I think now it's now costing the state around £150 billion a year. It might need a fact check on that one, but it's an extraordinary amount of money. And so you think about this, the tax base that Britain is facing, which, as I said, is the people in the private sector that go out to work, that keep the economy going, that generate economic activity and ultimately tax revenues, they are being squeezed in two fronts. They're being squeezed to pay for a larger but inefficient public sector and a growing benefits bill. It's a pretty extraordinary cocktail right now. And you look at the demoralisation that this is leading to young people in Britain, many of whom who are leaving university and going straight on to benefits. And there's very interesting Financial Times report out today, the 22nd of January, which talks about the total drought in the graduate jobs market. I think that it does extend beyond Britain. There's definitely issues with graduate jobs in America as well, after a very hot jobs market, but it does seem quite acute in the UK right now, and it is a pretty alarming state of affairs.
I think you touched on a very important point there, because quite often, I think, in the economy, we're looking at figures to inflation, which again this week has been shown to be sticky upwards. We look at overall GDP and perhaps GDP per capita, and we see that's been reducing over time. We perhaps look at the UK position in relation to some of our European partners and on our in the league table, how we're performing. So some of we also look at the value of sterling against other currencies as well. But employment and unemployment is a key metric, and I think that's something that we ignore at our peril. And as you say, when the balance of economic activity is now favouring the public sector over the private sector, this is extremely worrying state of affairs and direction of travel. And the other thing, as you mentioned, is young people. It's becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and that gap of worklessness for 16 to 24-year-olds is getting bigger and bigger every month. Why do you think we are seeing this in the UK?
It's a great question. I wrote a piece for the Critic magazine touching on the youth unemployment crisis recently, actually. I think there are a couple of reasons. I think some are long-term reasons and others are short-term. The longer-term reasons, I think, are mainly to do with the significant increases in the minimum wage, particularly for younger workers, which has actually regrettably made employing young people, particularly in the casual way that young people first get their original jobs. I used to work cash in hand for bookshops when I was a teenager, in a crockery company, washing pots and dishes on summer holidays and Christmas holidays. That has just become more difficult. There's way more paperwork associated with it. The wages have gone up, and the level of output that you might get for a teenager in his or her first job often is below what the minimum wage demands. So therefore, you're disincentivized to employ younger people in more informal ways. Then combined with the expanse of the welfare state, which I just mentioned, which is clearly providing a better life than the low-wage work in many parts of the economy, the expansion of higher education has delayed young people's entrance into the workforce. And regrettably, it's expanded higher education so far that I would say probably 50% of current students probably shouldn't have gone to higher education. And we would admit, and I think there would be a healthier jobs market for younger people. The recent massive spike in immigration hasn't helped either, particularly because it's working age adults arriving who will have a certain level of job work experience under their belts, or people who have come on the post-study graduate visa that international students get. And there was an interesting report by the Migration Advisory Committee, I think published last year or the year before, which showed how a huge number of people who've arrived as international students, supposedly to our world-class higher education sector, ended up working stacking shelves in supermarkets after their graduation. If our, higher education is being sold as an elite export, supposedly around the world, and the students actually coming here from different countries around the world are ended up working in supermarkets, I think something has gone rather wrong. And then another sort of, I think, structural problem with the state of the economy right now comes in the form of energy policy. It might not seem like it's explicitly related to the job prospects of young people right now, but it's the fundamental ingredient of prosperity. It's the fundamental ingredient of a modern economy. Britain has the highest costs of energy in the developed world. It's an extraordinary reason now not to invest in Britain, not to grow your business in Britain. And you look at the fact that the chemicals industry is just disappearing before our eyes, that we do not create any fertilizer in Britain anymore, despite being self-sufficient in fertilizer only less than a decade ago. These are areas of the economy which were previously able to provide a large amount of pretty good quality employment, and now they're just disappearing before our eyes. And so the options for many people are the welfare state, realistically, or ducking out from society entirely.
When we look at these facts and figures, one of the alarming issues that occurs to me is the incentives that society, that the government is setting up, both for employers, for employees, but for citizens of the UK. And one of the things that I think is extremely worrying is how we are incentivizing people to behave in certain ways, which of course is the way the government has always used policy to incentivize or disincentivize certain patterns of behavior. How do you see what the Labour government is doing right now as effectively stalling our economic strength?
I think that's very true. I think also Labour has a pretty long history of doing this as well. Look at the way Gordon Brown hugely expanded the welfare state to the working middle classes in the late 90s and early 2000s with the tax credit regime, which was unnecessary, right? But what it did do was it provided a way for more and more people to feel slightly dependent on the state and therefore vote accordingly, right? I think some of the legislation they're introducing right now is indicative of this. Obviously, there's a huge hesitance among Labour to cut working age welfare. We all saw what happened in June last year when Rachel Reeves failed to cut even £5 billion off a welfare bill of over £140 billion. Right now, the Employment Rights Act, which just came into force about a month ago, is a really, really good example of this too. This is a piece of employment law which was driven by Angela Rayner and the trade unions. And essentially, it's about trying to turn private sector working culture into the public sector. You have a government right now which is made up of people who have overwhelmingly only ever worked in the public sector or in the third sector, like charities and trade unions, and have therefore they've been used to a very, very compliance, highly regulatory focused employment environment, which is not really focused on output or the bottom line or getting things done. It's focused relentlessly on process. The Employment Rights Act, with the massive reduction in probation periods, expansion of rights to employees on the first day in work, the attempts to restrict 0-hour contracts, is a move to turn Britain's relatively flexible labour market, which allows opportunities for meritocracy, for promotion, for advancement of great people, and very importantly, the removal of people that are a bad fit in a company or are underperforming. And we're turning it much more like the public sector, or actually rather like France. And France as a country has many attributes, but their labour market is not one. The things around trade union recognition in the Employment Rights Act are almost like French trade union laws on steroids. I think there's a consultation out at the moment where the threshold for unionisation of a private sector company is going to be reduced to some 20 employees. In France, it's 50. And the incentive you get in France is there's loads and loads of companies which employ 49 people and then a complete fall off when you get to 50. If we introduce a threshold of 20, we'll see the same here. And that's just going to be a disaster.
It's similar, isn't it, to VAT thresholds for small businesses, that we have a
Massive.
VAT threshold of I think it's £90,000, might be £85,000. I know
Into
you
the
can hear me.
90s now, yeah.
Jeremy Hunt raised it by £5,000 when they were in
That's it.
government, but it hasn't been raised since. And you've got the exact same thing. You have a cliff edge where small businesses decide, oh, I'm going to stop trading now. I'm going to take January off. I'm not going to work in December. Particularly for small self-employed tradesmen, electricians, plumbers, etc.
Yeah.
Because for them, the hassle of being VAT registered and having to do quarterly returns, despite modern technology, but many of these people, let's face it, are out every day fixing our washing machines and our cars. They're not sitting in front of a computer working out how to make tax digital, which the government wants to push at us at every level. But these small businesses, of course, micro businesses maybe, again, you see exactly the same incentive. And what really bothers me is that we're setting up these incentives. And as you mentioned, Gordon Brown back in the 1998, 1999, when tax credits were introduced, unfortunately, what happens is that the population gets addicted to the heroin of backup, that the state is going to back them up. Now, this mentality, it erodes a sense of personal responsibility. It
Yeah.
erodes a sense of freedom. And of course, because of that, as you mentioned, you have people who are torn politically in terms of who they vote for because they don't want to bite the hand that feeds it.
It's quite a real dynamic. I know it makes some people act like they've given up on democracy. I remember speaking to some, very libertarian economists at a conference recently, and they thought that the growth of the welfare state has undermined the concept of democracy entirely because people will just keep voting for more welfare benefits, and an ever dwindling group of people will have to pay for them, but they'll be outvoted at every turn. I'm not quite as pessimistic as that. I think that. I still have a large amount of confidence in the British people because I actually, when you think about it, in our history, we do have a good track record of snapping out of these spirals. But we do end up in these spirals for quite a long time. The decline of the 1970s lasted a good bout of a decade, basically, before we were able to snap out of it. And it was clearly quite a traumatic first few years in the 1980s before the economy turned around and living standards improved. But one of the most exciting things about that was this rise of, let's say, private sector civil society, the Freedom of Association, the Ratepayers Associations, all these groups of people that realised that the state was taking them from them at every turn, and they organised voluntarily to campaign for their vision. Of course, the way politics worked in the 70s, they overwhelmingly went into the Conservative Party. Clearly, in the 2020s, that's going to be slightly different. But I think there has to be a way in which parties like Reform, in particular, but also if parts of the Conservative Party do want to do this and care about this, embrace this kind of taxpayer consciousness, as it were. It's not just about the rates of tax, it's about where all our money is going. Look at the social contract and look at what we're obliging people that get out of bed and go to work to make a living. Look at what we're obliging them to fund. I think there's probably still a critical mass of these people that, if they voted accordingly, could affect elections for the better, but it will need a serious amount of organisation.
Yes, and I think it's going to need people to be really enthused and
Yeah.
garnered to be able to take action, that we need
Yeah,
to
totally.
energize them to get out there and actually put their cross on the on their voting slip. That's going to be critical. We've got to do that.
Yeah, precisely.
So Fred, in terms of the Prosperity Institute, you are a free market think tank. You're looking at a lot of these different issues in terms of what's happening in the economy today. What would you say are the top three issues that within the Prosperity Institute you see as being the vital priorities for our country to address?
Well, the things we have been focusing on a huge amount in the last few months and the start of this year is energy policy. So our most recent two papers have been about energy policy. We actually published a paper today, 22nd of January, by a fantastic energy policy researcher called Rupert Darwall, called It's Broke, Fix It: How to Get Out of Britain's Energy Policy Mess. That is a very, very interesting piece of analysis looking at 25, 30 years of failure of energy policy, essentially from the entrenchment of the green energy regulations and the green energy vision, and how it has eroded Britain's reliable, dispatchable capacity. As I said earlier, energy is the bedrock of prosperity, and we do not have reliable energy anymore. In December last year, we published a paper called Destroying the Foundations, which is all about how net zero has wrecked Britain's industrial economy specifically. So we looked at some really, really in-depth analysis at different parts of the economy, not just steel that everyone focuses on, but glass, cement manufacturing, ammonia, fertilizer, bricks, all these sorts of things which make up the economy, which make up the physical world around us, and how they have been really damaged in Britain by high energy prices. And obviously, this is something we care about hugely. We want to make sure a future regulatory environment addresses this. So we need to look at repealing things like the Emissions Trading Scheme, which is a brutal carbon tax we apply to all energy-intensive users in this country, which puts British businesses at a massive disadvantage. We need to look at the Climate Change Act and potentially repealing that, because the Climate Change Act doesn't just mandate reductions in carbon dioxide, it also set up the QANGO, the Climate Change Committee, which sets carbon budgets for 5 years at a time, 10 years in the future, which will mandate what you and I, well, your listeners will have to, the world will have to live in the near future, which will mean more expensive flights. It will mean a deliberate policy-induced reduction of the size of our meat and dairy industry, because the Climate Change Committee want this to happen. So these are kind of the sort of insane constitutional and economic effects that the Green policy has been having in the last 25 years. But beyond that, constitution is a good segue point. We last year we published a paper on why and how to leave the ECHR. That paper we launched with Conservative MP Suella Braverman. It was also endorsed by Reform's Richard Tice, who spoke at the launch event. It was a really, really good moment where we could bring together big names on the British right about what it means to actually leave the ECHR, how you do it, what to do with the question of Northern Ireland. We believe that there is a reasonable resolution there, but it has to have some serious strategic thinking about getting there. And of course, when you leave the ECHR, what does that mean for two things? One, our relationship with the European Union, and two, what do we do about human rights as a concept in the future? Those are two things that we are publishing on, researching intently, and I think the European Union question is only going to get more important this year, because it looks like the Labour Party are giving up on governing the country and want to use the EU recess just to realign with the European Union. That is going to be a dreadful outcome, and it's something everyone has to watch out for this year.
It's good to know that within Prosperity Institute, you're looking not just at capital in terms of economic capital, but also human capital. How to affect the lived experience of people. I know that's a bit of a well-worn phrase. Last week, I was at an event, and one of the speakers mentioned that £18,000 a year per household is being spent on the welfare budget. That effectively, if we were to distribute the welfare budget across households, that's how much effectively we are subsidising our welfare bill by. The other one, of course, is energy. And repeatedly, Ed Miliband has promised that our energy bills are going to come down. But of course, we see the opposite happening. It seems that the Labour government make an announcement on one thing, but in fact, the opposite happens. And energy price, as you say, energy costs are absolutely critical, not just the price, but the supply of it. And I think this week, in Davos, President Trump has been very, very blunt. I don't know if you saw his speech about windmills. is well worth watching. He said that despite the fact that China are the major global manufacturer of windmills, they do not use windmills to harness or distribute energy, and that should tell us something. And he said they basically only use them as a showroom. They have windmill farms, but they're not actually in use. They're simply there for their foreign buyers to show them what they would look like when they buy them from the Chinese and then install them on their land rather than on Chinese land. And I think it's fascinating that we're seeing a lot of pushback on net zero. We're seeing a lot of those what have been sort of commonly distributed beliefs that many of us never did believe in, but they are being questioned now. They're being challenged, and it's I think it's because now, to use a well-worn phrase, the rubber's hitting the road. The costs are now becoming much more visible to the ordinary consumer, and the ordinary consumer is standing up and saying, "Hang on a minute, mate. My gas bill's gone up. My electric bill's gone up. Why is this?" And people are getting much more aware of the costs that they're facing.
This is very true. I think that it's one of the biggest pieces of 2000s and 2010s orthodoxy, which is collapsing. And it's interesting to try and look at the reasons why. I think one is the fact that the era of zero interest rates is no more. So that era was an era where financial gravity didn't really apply. Like that inflation wasn't very high, interest rates were really low, nothing seemed to change this. They were really low for a decade. The pandemic happened and they were low for even the first half of the pandemic. And so a lot of people built themselves into this false sense of security that the assumptions that were keeping the subsidies of wind farms going, along with a relatively stable natural gas price before the war in Ukraine, that we could just persist with this sort of magical thinking. And this all comes crashing to a halt with the end of the pandemic. The spike in inflation, the war in Ukraine, and the rise in interest rates everywhere. All of a sudden, money is much more real and debts are far more real. And it's so interesting looking at the controversy around allocation round seven, Ed Miliband's latest subsidy wheeze for the wind industry. In previous editions, allocations one to five, they didn't get a huge amount of criticism. That was just seen to be the way renewable energy was funded, and everyone believed that it worked. Allocation round six was basically a failure, because that was the first one in the era of the end of zero interest rates. And the subsidies available, that, well, rather, the strike price, which I suppose is a form of subsidy, it's not paid by the taxpayer, it's just paid by you and me and all of our listeners on our bills. The subsidy offered was not high enough. That should have sent alarm bells ringing that what? After 20 odd years of pushing the wind industry, it is still demanding more subsidies. We would have thought that this technology would be viable, but right now. And now with allocation round seven, the energy secretary has guaranteed an extraordinarily high strike price for 20 years. So it's like locking yourself into a remortgaging at the highest interest rates imaginable for 20 years. And it's so interesting that the debate on this has finally opened up. It was probably thanks to Richard Tice changing the terms of discussion when he said a reform government would not recognise these contracts. It's a bold, bold move. Some people say it will activate investor protections, treaties, and all this sorts of thing, but it was a really, really interesting, quite high-risk thing for him to do. And lo and behold, a few months later, the Conservative Party basically copies them and says something similar. So you've got two of the right-wing parties making this point, and it changes the tone of discussion massively. And now the Energy Secretary and the government are facing way more scrutiny than they otherwise would. So maybe we'll get to the truth somewhere. The issue is this government is so stubbornly opposed to increasing gas generation capacity. We have so many gas-powered power stations coming offline in the next decade. We have overregulated their creation and construction. So actually, they will take longer to build than they previously used to. Our nuclear project is kind of faltering. Obviously, we have some of the most expensive nuclear construction costs in the entire world. Yes, it's good that Hinkley Point is on its way, but still delayed and over budget. Sizewell C is just going to be so extraordinarily expensive. And again, we don't know when that's going to start generating. Meanwhile, other nuclear power stations are coming offline. It's insane that the government thinks the solution is subsidized intermittent renewables, which face vast backup costs, vast curtailment costs, and we're told that maybe storage is around the corner. It's a sort of hall of mirrors and a hall of lies.
Now, I want to move on to think about our place in the world economy. This is a big topic. So bear with me on this one, Fred, but I'd really like to get your take on this. Over the last few weeks, of course, we've seen we've got the backdrop of the Ukraine war continuing. There doesn't seem to be a solution there, despite Trump's apparent intervention there, but Putin still seems to be very, very determined to carry on fighting, carry on the conflict. We've had Trump, of course, raising the stakes more and more over the last few weeks on Greenland, and this is the big, I think, international issue of the day. And of course, we also have the issue that the dollar is, the world reserve currency. And there are, there are many countries across the world who are now beginning to think that the only lever they have to, if you like, implore Trump to think differently about his approach to Greenland is to perhaps to start unwind to unwind their dollar-denominated debt. What impact do you think Trump's approach towards Greenland could have, and how could that affect the UK economy?
I mean, it's definitely causing a huge amount of emotional strain in the Western alliance, which, I mean, in some respects has been fraying or has been sort of questioned for a while now. I mean, Barack Obama, when he was president of the United States, talked about a pivot to Asia. And he was making threats to NATO beforehand, telling other NATO countries that they need to pull their weight with their funding. So Donald Trump didn't invent, American Euroscepticism. There was definitely a sense from Americans across the political spectrum that they wondered what value the European alliance was having. Obviously, it's coming in a very different tone and color from Donald Trump because he sees, as JD Vance would put it, the European Union as part of the global blue team in the way that obviously. Obviously, the Democrats wouldn't, because there was a similar sort of social liberal, social democratic neoliberal ideology was shared between the Democrats and the European Union. The Greenland thing is a sort of really florid example of this. I think to a certain extent, it's the US government being very excited by their successful raid in Venezuela against Maduro, and almost some people getting slightly high on their own supply. Because I'm unsure what the real value of this is. It's very, very interesting that Keir Starmer seems to have played a backroom role in trying to calm down tensions and negotiate whatever settlement that might be agreed right now about this sovereign bases agreement, I think the term is, which seems to be a sort of equivalent to how the US Navy has its section in Guantanamo Bay, and that's how their bases might operate in Greenland. If that's a thing that works, then maybe that calms down the issue. But it's clearly a case that many, many people in Europe, on both the left and the right, now feel very, very burnt and very upset, basically, by this, by a country that they assumed was a reasonably reliable ally, has now made very aggressive threats to their well-being. And I think there's faults on both sides. I think, for one, I think the European political class has been, let's say, complacent for a very long time. It really has overseen economic stagnation. Just look at the 2024 report by Mario Draghi into European Union competitiveness. It's a fascinating report which lays bare the extent to which the European Union has just been left behind in the economic race towards innovation and greater prosperity and greater productivity. But of course, since then, the European Union has done nothing about it. It's not done anything to address the problems raised by Mario Draghi and only seems to think more of the same, i.e., more Euro federalism, more sort of, regulatory harmonization, instead of competition within Europe and greater national democracy, which I believe they should pursue in a more British sense, but they're not going to do that. They just continue with more of the same. And the European Union has always been less hostile to China. That just seems to be very clear. I mean, France has made a point of being relatively pro-China in the last few years, and I think that's just a genuine ideological distinction. If America believes it to be as a part of a grand continental rivalry between America and China, I just don't think Europe believes that to the same extent. I think Britain is clearly the most China hawkish country in Europe, but even then, that's a divisive issue. Labour themselves in Britain are divided on China. I mean, Rachel Reeves wants to get foreign direct investment from China, and they think that approving the embassy is a good way of doing that. But then there's also a lot of concern about the treatment of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang too, and should that be knocked on in trade policy? So it's a mixed picture. Britain, I think, I don't know. Sometimes I think foreign policy is a distraction from domestic policy. I usually am most interested in domestic policy. I think looking out for the British people and looking at the a British person who's on a medium income and working out how to make his family's life better is a better thing for politicians to do than spend their time at summits. And I do always think it's better to focus on what you can control domestically, which is ultimately economic and social reform, which I think is what Britain should pursue and what European countries should pursue. Realistically, what does saber-rattling about the dollar prove? I don't think we're going to see the death of the dollar anytime soon. I think it's going to, there are so many reasons why it will remain a hegemonic currency and people would like it to do so. I do think that America has done too much aggressive saber-rattling over Greenland, which is of course owned by an ally, Denmark, who sent Danish troops into Afghanistan, who fought pretty proudly side by side, British and American troops, took casualties, went to the front line in a way that many other NATO countries did not send their troops to. So it does feel quite unjust that they were being made an example of. But ultimately, I think the European political class needs to look at how it improves the living standards of the European people. And the richer your own domestic population are, the more clout you have on the world stage. I think that's definitely the vision for Britain. If we can find a way of ensuring that Britain has a GDP per capita of £70,000 as opposed to our rather weak 40 odd thousand pounds today, Britain will have m far more clout on the world stage, will stand far taller on the world stage as a richer nation.
I completely take your point there. However, I think that while strength domestically is incredibly important, we have to accept that we do trade on a global level. And of course, Trump's threat of tariffs is very, very destabilizing. And we saw what the tariffs did when he first introduced them when he became the president. And of course, there were lots of negotiations to reduce those tariffs, and it was built on personal relationships. And he seemed to spend a lot of time having meetings with world leaders to really assess how much he liked them and therefore how
Yeah,
much he
true, yeah.
reduced the percentage of their tariff by. But again, this threat of tariffs, I think, is a serious one. And I think it is a sword that Trump loves to wield.
Yeah.
And therefore, while I do agree with you about domestic policy and domestic strength being a reason for us to then be on that world stage and to be able to negotiate effectively, we have to recognize that there is a quid pro quo, that we no man is an island. The UK is not an island, although we are an island, but in terms of the way that we have relationships and trading partners.
I think that's very true. I think America uses tariffs because it is the world's apex consumer. They think they wield a large amount of clout with those tariffs. And to a certain extent, they do. I mean, they have brought lots and lots of countries to the negotiating table to a greater or lesser degree. Britain has been a beneficiary to an extent of this one, which I think is very, very interesting. Maybe that's a consequence of how we trade with the United States. We do a huge amount of services trade with the United States, which is obviously unaffected by tariffs, which is a great thing. The digital economy trade between Britain and Europe, Britain and America across the Atlantic is fantastic, right? And that makes us more resilient to the threat of tariffs on the physical economy compared to the European Union. But also, let's see what happens tariffs domestically in America. I think it's probably wise that we are not embarking on a sort of tit for tat trade war in this country. I do think ultimately everybody does just kind of lose. There does have to be a solution to the questions around lack of economic resilience. I think I do understand that. I think Britain's, physical economy is very weak right now. I don't think that would be bolstered by tariffs. As I said, I think it would be bolstered by domestic economic reform. But then to America, the tariffs are going to have an effect. American voters feel inflation very, very keenly, and they react to inflation very, very keenly. Inflation was one of the biggest reasons that Biden was voted out of office in 2024. People do forget this, and tariffs do feed directly into inflation. And there has been a sense that is this the best use of time for a sort of insurgent government elected in 2024 to try and, rebuild America after the difficulty of the Biden years? So, I mean, let's see. And of course, the Supreme Court is supposedly ruling on tariffs soon. It's been delayed for ages now, but that's going to come. And that will reignite the situation politically, because will Trump replace the big tariffs with more narrow tariffs? Will he legislate for the tariffs? That will probably be too difficult. So again, the game will change soon, I expect, with the Supreme Court noise.
Let's move on to how you, within the Prosperity Institute, would therefore be advising a reform government.
So I think what I'd say to any party that would come into office with an agenda that shares principles that Prosperity Institute has is that what we try and do with our research is we do try and make our analysis from first principles. A very, very good thing about the research agenda we do here is we are less focused on small tactical technical changes to tweaks to mechanisms here and there, and we do have a greater focus on vision of what we believe Britain should look like, how to make the British people richer and happier, and how to restore Britain's national sovereignty, integrity of its borders and democracy. And I think anyone that wants to take on board an insurgent approach to government, which I think is necessary, particularly by the time the state of the British economy and the degradation of Whitehall and the bureaucracy and public services will look like by 2028, 2029, is ruthless prioritisation. You can't do everything. You have to work out exactly what are the most existential priorities to fix, which in my mind will be around immigration, border control, constitutional relationship between Parliament and the courts, particularly when it comes to immigration enforcement, energy policy, and taxation. And actually, presumably, the health service, if that doesn't get any better, which is obviously going to be a really, really knotty problem for any government to fix, but particularly one of a right-wing persuasion, considering the sensitivities around the health service. So I think it has to be about relentless prioritisation, has to be a relentless communication of why they're here in office to do what they do. I think the way in which government communicates with the public today is so deathly. It's so cold and tinny and sort of like lowbrow in a really depressing fashion. There's no narrative, there's no destination, there's no North Star, as it were, to bring the British people with them. Instead, we just have defensive communications, a sort of hopeless government on life support. There really, really does have to be a compelling vision.
Yeah, I think that's a very strong point. I actually have been making that myself this week to a number of
Interesting.
groups that I'm in, that we can't just be anti things, we have to be pro things, and we have to state what we see a vision to be of Great Britain, because I think Great Britain is great and it has some
Certainly.
incredible thinkers, it has some incredible scientists, it has some incredible mathematicians, it's got a huge, great history of intellectual endeavor, of entrepreneurial endeavor, and
Yeah.
that energy is being distributed across the world as we see people leaving the UK. Those
Yeah,
people
true.
who should be investing in the UK should be bringing outward investment into this country. It's not happening, and it's a tragedy. And unfortunately, the other thing is, of course, we're not having enough babies, Fred. Now, I'm afraid I can't solve that problem. I've done my bit by having four, but
Very good.
that is another problem which we haven't even touched on today. But having enough children could be the next climate change, the real climate change issue that we're ignoring.
It is going to be extraordinary because declining fertility has been used by some people to justify mass immigration. I think erroneously. I think it's completely incorrect, but it's a piece of analysis which does not die. But the thing is that mass immigration has not solved the issue at all. The vast majority of immigrant groups trend down to British fertility levels very, very quickly because it's largely related to culture and living standards. And when you move away from a world where having children is almost like a necessity to a choice, unsurprisingly, the numbers are going to decline. I think Britain, I think that there has been a bit of a steeper fall off since the pandemic, but I think many of these things are not related to. I think a lot of them are fundamentally related to the strained living standards the British people have undergone for quite a long time now. The who does society benefit? And it doesn't really benefit the working middle class in the way that it used to. The cost of housing is incredibly expensive. Childcare is incredibly expensive. And of course, you shouldn't just look at numbers on a spreadsheet to decide whether or not to start a family, but these things do have a knock-on effect and they do affect the culture. And the fact that there is just a sense that life is not as easy or easy to accelerate, easy to build as it used to be, it does have a bit of a cooling effect on people's vision of the future. It harms their enthusiasm for the future. And I think enthusiasm for the future is an absolutely essential thing to rebuild, to fix the problems around family formation in this country.
Fred, It's been great to talk to you. There are more topics that I would like
Yeah,
to cover, but for the sake of
certainly.
our listeners who have got probably lots of things to be doing with their day, I'm gonna bring this interview to an end. But thank you very, very much indeed for answering a lot of my questions and expanding on a lot of those issues. We'll put the links to the Prosperity Institute in the show notes, because if anyone wants to find out more about you, what you're doing, events that you might hold, papers that you're releasing, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interest in that. And we look forward to staying in touch with you, and we'll get you on the show maybe in another 6 or 8 months' time. There'll be more news to discuss then. There'll be more issues that we can dig down deeper into. And I think that for people to look out for you, I hope you'll be at the next Reform Party conference.
I hope so too. It was such fun last September, and I'm sure it'll be bigger and better next September. And surely you'll have a podcast studio there to interview guests and speakers in the NEC or wherever it is next this time.
Yes, we'll see about that. If
Yeah.
not, I'll be on the roving mic coming to find
Indeed.
you.
Thank you very much, Wendy. It was lovely to chat.
You too. Thanks, Fred.
Excellent.